Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a couple of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and talk with Dr. Saad Al-Faqih, who is in London. He is the head of the opposition in exile from Saudi Arabia. And recently he called for an uprising in Saudi Arabia this last week and called for people to demonstrate. And we'll be talking to him about what is happening inside Saudi Arabia, a key U.S. ally, the world's largest oil supplier, and a country that is appearing to becoming increasingly vulnerable to an insurgency led by Al-Qaeda, the Saudi Al-Qaeda, who recently attacked the U.S. consulate in Jeddah. And that attack on the U.S. consulate in Jeddah, by the way, was led by a former member of the religious police, the Mutawa. So that does not bode well. We'll be talking about that. We'll also talk with Milton Leitenberg, who's a senior research scholar at the Center for International and Security Studies at the University of Maryland. He's a specialist in biological weapons and toxins, and we'll be looking into the poisoning of the Ukrainian opposition leader by dioxin. Clearly, there's a genesis of toxins having been created by KGB labs, and we're looking into poisons as a tool of political assassination. And then we will talk about the failed ballistic missile test, in spite of the fact that most of the tests for this new national missile defense system have failed. The Bush administration is determined to go ahead and spend billions and billions of dollars. They're doing it as we speak in up in Alaska, building and deploying a system that's not only not working, it's not passing the tests as, you know, before. Normally, with defense contractors, they have to meet certain standards in order to get the money, but apparently they're just basically opening up the treasury here, and the contractors are just shoveling money out the door without having to even show that the systems that we're buying work, and let alone defend the United States. I'm now speaking with Dr. Saad Al-Faqih, who is in London. He is a leader of the Saudi opposition in exile. Tell me what your call was last week, so I hear it from you. What were you hoping to achieve, and what was achieved on the streets of Saudi Arabia?
Well, what we called for is a demonstration, which would be an expression by people that they are there for asking for a comprehensive change of the system. The regime was aware that the call is serious, and aware that there is a high chance of very good turnover. So the regime took it very, very serious. And the cities which we called for was Riyadh and Jeddah, which are the two major cities in Saudi Arabia. And almost all the two cities were blocked. All the entrances to the two cities were blocked, and there has been very, very big crowds and traffic in the entrance of the cities. But inside the cities, there has been almost a big area, 10 by 10 kilometers, very well covered by thousands of police, searching every three persons together to prevent people from getting into the center of this area, which is supposed to be the spot of our demonstration. Now, despite all this, few hundreds of people did make their way through in Jeddah, but thousands, something like 2,500 in Riyadh, and 2,500 had been arrested in each city. And of course, most of them were released later, but they were arrested when they were trying to get their way through. Many, many others have not been able to get through because of the traffic jams and the blocks of the roads. And so we say that although the real physical gathering did not happen the way we wanted it, but what we say is the regime has almost admitted has given us a recognition of the immense response by mobilizing thousands of police in order to prevent this demonstration. And because of that, we are going ahead with this series of demonstrations, and we assume that the regime is incapable of going on with this immense mobilization of the police, and keeping in mind that we are getting into the annual pilgrimage days very soon, the next few weeks, and the regime usually mobilizes its police into the pilgrimage season, and also keeping in mind that there is a new threat from Bin Laden targeting oil installations and royal family, so the regime will not keep the police busy with peaceful demonstrators, and otherwise it will expose those targets.
And of course, you're referring to Bin Laden's latest missive that arrived a few days ago, and a recording which they've pretty much verified as Bin Laden, and he's calling. First of all, he praised the attack on the U.S. Consulate in Jeddah, and I understand that the leader of that attack, who was killed, was a former member of the religious police, the Mutawin. So that sounds to me like that could be the beginning of the unraveling of the House of Saud, because isn't that the basic compact there, that the House of Saud has made a deal with the religious police and the Wahhabis? You can do your thing, just leave us alone, and we'll take all the money and we'll buy you off. And is that arrangement falling apart?
Not really. I mean, this is a little bit superficial understanding of the whole story. What's happening in Saudi Arabia in the last few months, and probably even the last 2 years, two, 3 years, the complete restructuring of the relation between the society and the royal family, the recognition and the understanding and respect and loyalty to the royal family has become almost artificial. It's no longer real loyalty based on religious or social basis. Nobody now takes the royal family seriously in the religious measures, nor in social measures, not even in historical standards. The royal family now is conducting its affairs in a very almost on temporary basis, relying on paying off some powers inside the country, and also utilizing the police and intelligence to the maximum. And of course, using the international support, especially from the U.S. government. So the real loyalty and the real respect long-lasting relation of the basic Saudi tribal religious society is over. It's no longer there. One of the interesting events recently in Saudi Arabia is that what we have done through our radio station, which we broadcast from Europe back to Saudi Arabia, and which is almost like a real talk show. We have asked people to declare their names if they are supporters of the regime or supporters of us, and we succeeded in publishing 50,000 names of people putting their real names from all types of society, giving loyalty to us and severing their loyalty to the regime. Now, that was in the beginning just simple printed names on a screen, and there was a question about the authenticity. So what we moved next after that was, in the last few weeks before this demonstration, and that was actually the reason why we thought confident for the demonstration, is that people putting statements from certain tribes and families and areas read by the person who has been behind collecting the names in the statement in his own real voice, and reading the names of the people in that statement on our own TV or radio station. And we secured something like 110 statements, each statement having something like 70 to 200 people in the same statement. So a total of 10,000 people, fully authentic, declaring their loyalty to Mira, that's our group, and severing their loyalty to what we call, in what you call in the old terminology, homage, severing their homage to the king. Mm-hmm. This has been unprecedented in Saudi Arabia, a very courageous and brave act, which would have never happened only a few months ago. That exposes how artificial the current control of the royal family on society in Saudi Arabia. So it's very superficial to say if it is only religious police or scholars.
I understand. Well, it's a complex situation, and I was giving a very shorthand version of things. And again, let me remind the audience that I'm speaking with Dr. Saad Al-Faqih, who is in London. He's the head of the opposition in Saudi Arabia that's in exile. And of course, it's worth noting that the opposition to Saudi Arabia in exile is in London, not in the United States. And yet, at the same time, it's President George W. Bush, the present president of the United States, who says that he's trying to bring democracy to the Middle East, and that's why we're at war with Iraq. So you're trying to bring democracy to the key country in the Middle East, Dr. Al-Faqih, and are you getting any help from the United States? Because obviously Al-Qaeda wants to bring theocracy to Saudi Arabia, not that theocracy isn't a big element in the government.
Well, I mean, I'm sorry to say that the United States have never done a single step in towards power sharing, accountability, transparency, or independent judiciary. They have pushed very, very hard for more people to be arrested because of the September 11 mentality. They pushed very, very hard to change our curriculum in schools to fit with the way people understand America and the West. They pushed very hard to freeze all our charities, something which has not taken place even inside America. And that all those measures have been implemented. They have been accepted by the Saudi government and implemented with pleasure. 3,000 scholars and preachers in the mosque have been sacked. The whole system of what we call da'wah, that's preaching, has been revised, but not a single prisoner calling for reform has been released by American pressure. There are three prisoners are actually liberal reformers, not even calling for reform under Islamic auspices. They are liberal reformers. They have not been released. There has not been a single frank statement from the American government asking for them to be released or to be given a chance for change. So there's no real step by American government to push for anything which could be defined as democracy. There has been a huge pressure on things to do with terrorism, which are actually pushing people more and more with frustration and anger and more hatred towards the United States, but not a single step or even minor step towards real power sharing and accountability and transparency.
But this is seems to be counterintuitive, and certainly goes against the stated aims of the new Bush foreign policy, because things have changed in the Middle East now.
Yes, I can challenge anybody on any platform with a full, frank debate. I can prove that there has not been anything fits with what they are claiming in public.
Well, tell me, though, what, from your knowledge of Saudi Arabia, if there was, people obviously, it's a police state, and I think only if three or four people gather, the police immediately break you up. So that's why, you know, and you said they preemptively stopped the demonstration that you called for by sealing off the cities. Give me a sense of what the climate is inside the country for liberal reform, and what kind of a a political arrangement would you like to see?
Well, I mean, if you mean by liberal reform the procedures of democracy, that's power sharing, accountability, transparency, everybody is asking for that. There is almost a consensus among all sensible people in the country, whether they are in the left or right end of the spectrum. Every sensible person asking for reform would agree in some sort of accountability, transparency, power sharing, eradication of corruption, absolute freeze of the royal family privileges. Everybody agrees on that. But there's a question about the auspices of all of this. I mean, is Saudi Arabia is taken for granted as a country where there is no way that you can bypass Islam as auspices? But the point we disagree with the regime, which also claims that it is it is Islamic. So we say that the interpretation of Islam does not mean absolute loyalty to a corrupt, despotic king and his royal family. That is what they are promoting and bringing us a bunch of Islamic scholars who are marketing this story. Now, what do we say? We say interpretation of Islam politically means power sharing. It means real open accountability and transparency and absolutely independent judiciary, with freedom of expression, freedom of assembly. So the general auspices of Islam is unquestionable in Saudi Arabia, but the interpretation of Islam, most people call for open interpretation. The regime insists on monopolic interpretation of Islam.
Well, just a final question for you, Dr. Saad Al-Faqih. What do you understand and know about the theory that's out there that you often hear, that the Saudi royal family were fed up with the American government vis-a-vis their handling of Iraq, and they basically said to them, look, you know, do something or just forget about it. You either get rid of Saddam or you live with him, but we're sick of this thing. And furthermore, we all know that the Saudi government then expelled the Americans, which they had to do for domestic reasons and pressure coming from bin Laden, presumably, was factored into that. What role did Saudi Arabia take in because there's a theory that the United States went into Iraq because the Saudis basically kicked them out.
No. There's a thing which the Saudis are doing, and there's a thing which Saudis, I mean, when I say Saudis, I mean the royal family.
Mm-hmm.
There's a thing which the royal family is doing in reality, and there is something which they want, they wish.
Mm-hmm.
The thing which they are doing in reality is they are supporting everything the Americans want. They have provided them with land, they've provided them with money, with logistical support, with free oil. They have they wanted them to give free oil to Jordan, and that did happen. They supported their regional policies in order to make the campaign on Iraq successful. The Saudis cannot refuse any American demand, especially in the strategic and military sense, because the Saudi royal family has based its life on continuous support and control by a superpower. In the old days, it was Great Britain, and now it is United States. That is what the Saudi royal family is doing. What the royal family wants is the current situation to continue. They do not want United States to be defeated and expelled from Iraq, because that would mean the new power in Iraq is very so powerful that it will start invading Saudi Arabia, or at least infect the local societies in a way which people start jihad against their own dictators. So they do not want the current resistance to supersede in Iraq. Now, they also do not want America to have full control and Iraq to become stable and pumps enough oil to the degree that floods the flood the markets, and then the oil prices would sink down, and they stop controlling people, or at least the powerful key powers in the country by paying them off. So the best thing for the Saudi royal family is for the current situation, which is no defeat for the Americans to continue.
And what about what's the agenda then? Of given that much of the suicide bombers in terms of the insurgency in Iraq are Wahhabis, and that Iraq has become a magnet for jihadis, Bin Laden's people, it's almost as if Iraq is a gift to Bin Laden.
Exactly. I have said that even before the war. I said it's going to be a heaven's gift to Bin Laden for America to get into Iraq. Now, Iraq is not Afghanistan. It's not Chechnya. It's not Bosnia. Iraq is in the heart of the Arab world, and it is full of powerful Sunni tribes and very well-trained people, have very good training in military activity. And Iraq, by its nature, is a next-door neighbor to Saudi Arabia and to Jordan, to Syria. And people would flux easily to Iraq in order to practice jihad. So it was heaven's gift to Bin Laden in order to provide a very active and lively spot for jihad. Now, but that does not mean the royal family is providing manpower or providing people for jihad. To be honest, although we want the royal family to get in trouble with America, although we like the idea that they are accused of being this and that, but to be fair and honest, I absolutely absolve them of supporting anything of that activity because they know that they cannot get away with it. There is a big American eye on them. And the other point they don't want it is that those jihadis do not accept half deals. They are enemies to royal family. They are enemies to America, full stop. So there is no way they can make a limited deal with the royal family in order to fight America.
Well, thank you for joining us. I realize that you're broadcasting to Saudi Arabia as we speak, and I appreciate the fact that you were able to give us some time and join us here in Los Angeles. Dr. Saad Al-Faqih, thank you. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Dr. Saad Al-Faqih, who is the head of the Saudi Arabian opposition in exile in London. And he called for a demonstration this week inside Saudi Arabia, which happened to coincide with Bin Laden's latest missive. Let's now go to the subject of not so much biological weapons, but toxins, and how they've been used as a tool of political assassination, particularly in the former Soviet Union and in its successor state of Russia, and of course the most prominent case being the poisoning of Viktor Yushchenko, the Ukrainian opposition leader, who was campaigning and came down with this hideous injury that, for a politician, is a kiss of death, where his face turned into, from a handsome man into kind of the elephant man, following a dinner on September the 5th of this year with the head of the Ukrainian Secret Service, Ihor Shmesko, and his deputy, Vladimir Satskyuk. I'm not sure of whether he would recognize that name, but that's the best I can do. And apparently, the speculation is that he was poisoned in some soup, which is fat-soluble in the docks, and was able to be administered that way. And it seems pretty clear that they decided to use dioxin because of the effects it would have on Yushchenko's face. And as I mentioned, that would be the worst thing that could happen to a politician, particularly in the middle of a campaign. Milton Leitenberg is a senior research scholar at the Center for International and Security Studies at the University of Maryland and a specialist in biological weapons, biological warfare, and toxins. Give me a sense, then, what you think the provenance of this dioxin is. Did the local Ukrainian KGB clones come up with this on their own, or did the their brothers in Lubyanka, the old KGB, passed the stuff on to them?
Well, probably not the Lubyanka. That was a prison.
Well, that's what the square. That's what they call the Russians called KGB. Yeah,
that's where the headquarters and in a sense interrogation and prison. No, there are other institutes in other parts of Russia. Let's go back a bit. Toxins are in fact listed both in the two treaties, the Chemical Weapon Convention and in the Biological Weapon Convention. So they're classed as either biological weapons or chemical weapons. And one should also remember that in the Ukraine, under President Kuchma, there have been other very high profile political murders that didn't involve poison. A former presidential candidate, Vyacheslav Chertovil, was killed in a very standard KGB method, which goes back to the 1930s. He was run down by a large truck. And then there was this journalist who, the headless body was found several years ago, and there are tapes from a former bodyguard of President Kuchma in which he's speaking to his interior minister and apparently giving the orders that this journalist, Gungadze, should be done away with. And a police officer who testified about all this was then beaten to death in prison. So there are activities in Ukraine in the past few years that didn't involve poison, but did involve high-level political killings. Now, it's probably, to go directly to your question, it's probably unlikely that this material was synthesized, and I say synthesized, that's very important, in the Ukrainian facility. It's not impossible for a very good organic chemist to make this in a laboratory, but he has to be quite experienced. It's not an easy thing to do. In industrial processes, there are very many, several hundred, of the dioxin-type molecules. This was a pure preparation of one of them, called TCDD, tetrachlorodibenzoparadioxin, which is the most toxic of them. That is almost definitely proof that it was produced, synthesized, not gotten as a byproduct in some industrial process. And you would first look to laboratories that had experience working with this molecule. And in one of the New York Times stories, there was mention of a laboratory in Volgograd in Russia. And that, in fact, that institute, research institute, which belonged to the Ministry of Health in the old Soviet Union, there were 14 of these institutes that dealt with toxicology in one way or another. That particular institute has lots of experience working with dioxin. They still list it on their website now in English. There's also two other institutes that might be possible suspects for where the compound came from. Beyond that, I don't think anyone can say. But the first suspicion would be to look for a laboratory with experience. And I have not been able to find anyone who can identify any such facility in the Ukraine.
So my suspicion stands then that there is some Russian authorship over this, at least in terms of transferring the poison, the means to carry out the political assassination. In this case, they didn't kill the victim. They tried to destroy his political hopes by turning him into the Elephant Man.
I agree with the first part of that. I wouldn't be so certain as to what the intention was. I don't think we can say at the moment. I don't think it will be a kiss of death, the phrase you used. I think the Ukrainian electorate will still go with Mr. Yushchenko, irrespective of the troubled face, the chloracne, as it's called. This is a very, very difficult question, trying to think of what was the intention of the people that did this. And there are two alternatives. One is the one you mentioned, simply to disfigure his appearance, and the other is to kill him. I probably tend to the second one, though it's a big puzzle. Obviously, if you simply want to upset his appearance, you also have to have a good idea of what dosage you're giving, because the chloracne only develops at very, very high dosages of this compound. And the high dosages are the ones that also could do the person in. It's not known what the lethal dose of this compound is in humans. There are values for primates, monkeys, and various other animals, guinea pigs and dogs. But it's not known for humans. Now, if you simply want to mess up his appearance, that might affect the election, but it might not. And if you simply want to affect his health in 3, 4, 5 years down the line, which this compound also will do, that doesn't help you much for the election. So that's an open question. Also, if you just upset his facial appearance, this chloracne, that's just waving a great big red flag, because there are not too many compounds that do that. And then people will go to do the assays that they did and discover what the compound is. So in fact, you're advertising what you've done, which is not terribly intelligent. It might have worked in the short term just before the election, but as you see, it didn't. So that's a kind of very risky thing to do.
Well, but it gets to the mentality of the people who do these things. They're just brazen thugs, quite often.
But that includes killing people. I just pointed out.
Oh, I think so. You've made it clear that you scar the guy hideously, or he dies, or in this case, you're going further, suggesting that in 3 or 4 years' time, he may well die.
Well, you may not indirectly. It tends to produce certain kinds of cancer,
sure,
as well. But that's a percentage change. You know, there were so many cases per 100,000 population or per 1,000 population. That number will be drastically increased. It can't be certain that he will get cancer. On the other hand, if he had died immediately, and everybody in Ukraine would have known that the previous night he had dinner, this late after midnight dinner with the two senior KGB people. We still use KGB, it's not the right term anymore, but in any case, that's also a big red flag. However, nobody would have gone to look for dioxin if that had happened. And I suspect that if that was their intention, great big capital if, they counted on having the autopsy done in the Ukraine, and it would be before, he would have died before any of this facial disfigurement, and then no one would have gone to look for dioxin.
So again, we're dealing with speculating about the malevolent intentions of professional killers.
Yeah.
And again, let me remind the audience, I'm speaking with Milton Leitenberg, as a senior research scholar at the Center for International and Security Studies at the University of Maryland, a specialist in biological weapons and toxins. And we're talking about the use of poisons and toxins as a political tool of political assassination. And there's been a number of, you mentioned a list of political assassinations in the Ukraine under Kuchma, whose hand-picked successor fraudulently won this election, and now there'll be next Sunday there'll be another election, and the expectation is that the disfigured victim of this poisoning will win the election, although his opponent has threatened to take his supporters out on the street. So the victory may bring about another round of instability.
Well, we will see. But I don't think at this point, no one assumes that, in fact, this medical condition on his face is going to impede him getting
No, no. Well, apparently it's actually had the reverse effect, because every time, he wasn't exactly a fiery figure, but apparently every time he looks at himself in the mirror, he just is filled with more resolve to go after these people. Now, let's turn to the notion of Russian authorship. We mentioned the fact that it's likely that a Russian lab synthesized the poison. There's been a number of political assassinations in Russia, and some near assassinations or neutralizations, I guess that you'd call them. There was a reporter who the Kremlin didn't like, that Putin didn't like. She was on her way down to Chechnya, and she was given some tea on an aircraft, and she got really sick. There was a, you know, when Putin first came in and restarted the Chechen War, prior to that, there was an apartment building that blew up in the outskirts of Moscow, and there's still some suspicions about who was behind that. It was blamed on the Chechens, but it became the provocation that justified a new round of the Chechen War. And there was a parliamentary inquiry into that. All of the heads of the parliamentary inquiry have been assassinated, including a former KGB colonel who I believe was poisoned in Austria. So there's quite a... You probably know even more than I do.
Well, that one I didn't know about. I didn't know about that one. There have been a whole bunch of assassinations, though. Supposedly, they assassinated... I don't know that anybody's been able to authenticate this, but this Arab, in quotes, senior Chechen...
Khatab,
he was allegedly poisoned, and the Russian government didn't suggest that they had nothing to do with it. There were other non-poisoning political assassinations, senior ones, both under Yeltsin and under Putin. I think Galina Starovoitova is probably the most important, and I can't remember under which administration, whether it was just at the end of Yeltsin or just after Putin came in, I think. She was simply shot in Leningrad, in her apartment, outside her apartment. But there have been quite a lot of others. Now, most of them are assumed to be, in quotes, mafia. But in Russia, the, in quotes, mafia and the former KGB have lots and lots of interactions. The really important question, I mean, the two big questions, of course, the first one we dealt with, what was the motive of whoever gave them the stuff? The second is, where did it come from, which you asked. And the third is, if you assume it came from Russia, and that still involves transmission through the intelligence people, the Ukrainian KGB, the two top guys, I don't think you can leave out President Kuchma. In all the instances that we know in the past in which this kind of activity took place, in the former Soviet Union, in our own country prior to 1969, two attempts which either didn't succeed or weren't carried out, the one against Patrice Lumumba in the Congo in 1960, and several attempts against Fidel Castro in the early 1960s. But then in Israel, and a pile of these did succeed, and some didn't succeed, and in South Africa, where some succeeded and some did not succeed. In all those cases, these things were not done by loose guns. They were not done by rogue elements, which some people sometimes theorize. Now, maybe the senior political leadership didn't know about it. Maybe they didn't order it. Maybe lower down folks presumed that they would be rewarded for this, and they would be meeting the wishes of their seniors, but they weren't ordered to. No, in all of the cases in which this has occurred that we know about in those four countries, former Soviet Union, the United States, Israel, and South Africa, all of these things were ordered by the senior political leadership.
And why do they choose poison over a bullet? I guess it's because...
Well, sometimes you can't do the bullet.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes you don't want it to be known. When the Soviets... Well, one of the Soviets planned assassinations, which did not take place, was against Marshal Tito of Yugoslavia. And in that case, they were going to use a plague bacterium and a dry powder, which was mixed with talcum powder. Obviously, they didn't want it obvious. When they threw Bulgarians, assassinated in London a senior...
Georgi Markov, yeah.
Georgi Markov, in 1978. Mm. He was a dissident, former diplomat. It was meant to be undiscovered. No one was meant to know why he had died. A small pellet of ricin was implanted in his leg with the tip of an umbrella. It was a bit of a fluke that someone in London, in fact, analyzed and mm-hmm. looked for the ricin. The Israelis, they have used compounds that have never been publicly identified. One can guess at what they are, which mimic a heart attack. And it's not supposed to be obvious. Despite the fact that they do lots of assassinations with car bombs and lots of assassinations with guns.
And cell phones, yeah.
Yes, which in other words have explosives in them.
Right.
Or the cell phone acts as a communicating device for an Israeli aircraft with a rocket above.
Sure.
In other words, they're all means of either a bullet or a bomb or a rocket. At the same time, there are cases that they simply want it not known, and those are the cases that one turns to poisons.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Milton. It's not the most appetizing subject, but it is extraordinarily flagrant that this has taken place. But it gives you an idea of the anti. The democratic forces that play here, both in the former Soviet Union and in the successor state of Russia itself, which seems to have been taken over by the KGB, the very people who may well be behind this assassination attempt. I thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Milton Leitenberg, who's a senior research scholar at the Center for International and Security Studies at the University of Maryland. He's a specialist in biological weapons and toxins. And I'm now speaking with Philip Coyle. He's a former Assistant Secretary of Defense. He was the head of test evaluation at the Pentagon, where he evaluated the programs of the Strategic Defense Initiative, which is now called National Missile Defense, the Osprey, the Crusader, and about 200 major systems. And just a few days ago, we had another test on the National Missile Defense, and it didn't even get off the ground, right? Phil?
That's certainly right. Good to be with you, Mr. Masters, and indeed, I didn't expect such a primitive sort of failure.
And has there been a postmortem on that yet? Does anybody know?
The Missile Defense Agency hasn't said yet, but it all indications are that it's a failure in what they call their command launch equipment, which interfaces with the interceptor on the ground.
And but this the thing that's different about this National Missile Defense, this reincarnation of Star Wars, SDI, now National Missile Defense, the fundamental difference is from when you're in the Pentagon, am I correct in saying that the Bush administration have basically given the contractors a free ride here, that even if you don't get it right, you still build it?
That's basically correct. They have exempted this program from the usual procurement rules, from the usual oversight mechanisms that all other major defense acquisition programs have to go through.
And what's the rationale for it? That this is a clear and present danger? That we
Well, I suppose they would say something like that, but they've never really said. There's very strong support for missile defense in the U.S. Congress, especially the Republican Congress. The president announced 2 years ago that he wanted to deploy the system by now. And so that's what the contractors have been trying to do, is to get hardware in the ground up at Fort Greely in Alaska and in Vandenberg Air Force Base here in California. And during that two-year period, until just the other day, there hadn't been a single flight intercept test. And then this one the other day failed, as the one before it 2 years ago also failed.
So if it's about pork... and about the military-industrial complex, which originally, of course, Eisenhower was going to describe it as a military-industrial congressional complex. So now that we're talking about the congressional element of this, the people in the Congress, the Republican Congress, why do they just want to just throw money at something like this? I mean, aren't there other things you can do to get the voters in your district happy with you?
Of course. Missile defense is a huge program. It's about $11 billion a year, more than either Canada or Australia spend for their entire militaries, for everything that they do in defense. But it's not simply pork, I think. There are many members of Congress who are true believers in missile defense and who believe there's a real threat. There isn't. Yet. There is no country that we consider an enemy that has missiles that can reach the United States. But I think those members of Congress would say, yeah, well, but they might soon. Someday they might.
Well, I guess you're referring to North Korea.
That's about what it would have to be, unless you think Iran might do that.
Well, North Korea, curiously enough, our policy of isolating North Korea and abandoning the track we were on before under Clinton has allowed the North Koreans a free hand to reprocess fuel rods to create plutonium. And the intelligence community estimates that they used to have two bombs, now they got up to eight. So are we, in effect, creating our own nemesis here? Because if North Korea is the justification for this tremendous profligate spending on a system that still, every time it's tested, it fails, but nevertheless, they're going ahead and deploying it. It's supposed to be to stop the North Koreans, and at the same time, our dysfunctional policy towards North Korea is giving them a free hand to make the nuclear weapons. Now, obviously, we're talking about two different things, the weapons, the warhead, and the delivery system, but I just, as I go through this in my mind, I think, am I living in the real world? Don't you think there's something dreadfully wrong with this, or is the White House that cynical that they are happy that North Korea is this dysfunctional failed state is actually, they want it to be a justification?
Well, an example of what you're talking about is, I think it was in 1999. That former Secretary of Defense William Perry, serving as an ambassador, not as Secretary of Defense, he had stepped down by then, made a series of trips to North Korea to convince them to stop working on long-range missiles, such as missiles that could reach the United States. And he was surprisingly successful. And when news of his success reached those of us who were in the Pentagon at the time, people used to joke, there goes the threat. So Secretary Perry showed that creative diplomacy can be very effective, and he was the most cost-effective missile defense system we ever had, even if North Korea had missiles that could reach the United States, which they didn't, and he worked to get them to stop working on that. But as soon as the Bush administration came in, they effectively trashed the work that Dr. Perry had done by starting to threaten North Korea all over again.
Well, it's as I say, they've basically the policy for whatever its stated intentions are is not working, because North Korea is adding to its nuclear arsenal, and there are no restraints on it. And originally, the plutonium program was frozen by the agreement that was made under the Clinton administration. And now, because Bush tore it up and abrogated it, they're free to make plutonium bombs, while we're accusing them of trying to make uranium bombs.
Yeah.
There's something about this picture that is quite disturbing. But just returning, again, let me remind the audience, I'm speaking with Philip Coyle, who's a former Assistant Secretary of Defense, and he's the head of test evaluation at the Pentagon, and we're talking about the $85 million test that took place last week that failed, part of the new National Missile Defense System that is being built in Alaska. And of course, you know, Alaska's senator there is he's a powerful guy, and there's apparently he takes he takes care of his constituents, I guess.
Well, there's a lot of work going on in Alaska for missile defense.
But what do you think, though, in terms of these setbacks? I mean, what allows this to happen? I find it extraordinary in the first place that we could be, you know, money could be hemorrhaging out of the treasury, and nobody seems to want to have any accounting. They don't seem to expect results. I mean, that it seems to go against all of the traditions of this kind of can-do country.
Well, exactly. And this in this test, the main purpose of this test was to show that the booster, the rocket for the interceptor, was you know, would work carrying its payload. And that it was effectively production representative, that is, ready to be produced in mass quantities. And obviously it isn't, if it never even gets off the ground. And what's been surprising about the determination of the administration to go forward with this system is that they don't seem to have any standards of effectiveness. There is no architecture for the system. The Missile Defense Agency insists that there is no architecture for the system, and so this is like building a house where the you know, where the floor plan is constantly changing. I suppose you can do it like the Winchester Mystery House, but you know, you get a real expensive house that way, and your family you know, despairs. But nevertheless, the system is going forward. They've installed six interceptors at Fort Greely in Alaska and one here at Vandenberg, and they'll be putting in three more at Vandenberg after the first of the year.
And in terms of missile defense, there are three stages where the incoming missile can be intercepted. The boost stage, where it is going up into the atmosphere. The mid-flight, where it's in outer space, and the terminal phase, where it's coming down. Now, terminal defense or point defense is probably the easiest thing to do, because particularly if you have valuable assets you want to protect, cities or infrastructure, then that's where you put your interceptors. And you know, I think that there were systems going back to the 1960s that were developed, but of course they had, I think they all had nuclear warheads, didn't they?
Yes.
And but the mid-flight section is the easiest thing to fool, because you can just put out a series of balloons in space that'll fly along beside the vehicle, and they act as decoys, and you can put as many balloons up as you want to fool the interceptors. And then the first boost phase, there are theories and plans to try and intercept that, but that would mean you'd have to have some huge kind of floating platform off North Korea around the clock tied in with constant overhead satellites. For the minute you picked up the missile burn, you'd have to fire the interceptors. And again, they would probably have nuclear warheads too. So even as I run through this, none of this sounds like it makes a lot of sense at any rate. So what if there's anything to this, what's the best thing that the taxpayer could be getting for their money?
Well, the system that's taking most of the $11 billion is a mid-course system. That's the one that's being deployed in Alaska and in Vandenberg. It doesn't have any capability in the boost phase or the terminal phase. Even if it worked perfectly, it doesn't. And it currently it has no demonstrated capability to work under realistic conditions anyway. In the boost phase, very tough. You've got to be very close to the enemy and very fast. And various scientific studies that have been done show that there may not be enough time. The system would have to be entirely automated. One thing that is proposed is to have attack weapons in space. That is to have satellites whizzing around over our heads in space that would come down and shoot down these missiles in their boost phase. But that's a horrendously expensive proposition. Also, if we even knew how to make it work, and we don't.
And of course, there are treaties against that. But
yeah.
I guess treaties don't necessarily bother this administration. But still, I don't mean to be flippant because this is real money.
It is. One group of independent economists in Washington estimated that if the system keeps going the way it is. That over the next 20 years, we could spend over $1 trillion on this system. And I've been astonished that there hasn't been more debate in the U.S. Congress about, at least having a system that works, that's demonstrated to work under realistic conditions before going ahead to deploy it.
Well, but the thing I find obscene about these ads now, even throughout the Cold War, the military contractors didn't really advertise on television, but now Boeing puts out these very kind of syrupy ads about how they're defending, and they show pictures of our troops in Iraq. The truth of the matter is that we don't take care of our military people. Look at this scandal involving the lack of armor on Humvees, which has accounted for most of the American casualties have been blown up in their Jeeps, their Humvees, and they can't even provide armor for these when it's so low-tech and so simple and chump change compared to the $10 billion it's going to cost to make a new stealth satellite that some of the senators on the Intelligence Committee went public on, warning the public about how they're being fleeced, and now we're talking about national missile defense. So do you think the American people are going to wake up at one point and realize that they're being had, that all of this stuff about patriotism and defending our troops, everybody has respect and admiration for the people in uniform, but they're getting short shrift. All the real money and the priorities go towards these systems, not towards helping the people in the field.
Well, exactly, and for $11 billion, about what we spend each year on missile defense, you can buy a lot of armor. And so it just makes no sense to me that our soldiers are scrounging in garbage dumps for pieces of scrap metal to hang on Humvees to protect themselves when we can spend this kind of money on a system, on deploying a system, I should say, that has no demonstrated capability to work under realistic conditions.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Philip Coyle.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Philip Coyle, as a former Assistant Secretary of Defense, and he was the head of test evaluation at the Pentagon during the Reagan and Bush administrations. This program and previous ones can be accessed at ianmasters.org. I thank Mark Maxwell, the engineer, Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Carol Coote, the assistant producer.